Have a question or need how-to advice? Just ask Meta AI. Whether you need to summarize your class notes or want to create a recipe with the ingredients you already have in your fridge, Meta AI has the answers. You can also research topics, explore interests, and so much more. It's the most advanced AI at your fingertips. Expand your world with Meta AI. Now on Instagram, WhatsApp, Facebook, and Messenger.
Earning your degree online doesn't mean you have to go about it alone. At Capella University, we're here to support you when you're ready. From enrollment counselors who get to know you and your goals, to academic coaches who can help you form a plan to stay on track, we care about your success and are dedicated to helping you pursue your goals. Going back to school is a big step, but having support at every step of your academic journey can make a big difference. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
At Ashley, you'll find colorful furniture that brings your home to life. Ashley makes it easier than ever to express your personal style with an array of looks in fun, trending hues to choose from earth tones to vibrant colors to calming blues and greens. Ashley has pieces for every room in the house in the season's most sought-after shades. A more colorful life starts at Ashley. Shop in-store, online today. Ashley, for the love of home.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.
Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
All righty. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Dealmakers Show. So today we have a very exciting story. We have an amazing founder, you know, that he's riding this rocket ship that we're going to be talking about in just a little bit. I mean, between obviously contractors and full-timers, you know, there are about 500 employees, 100 million plus raised. Incredible journey, you know, from dealing with COVID stuff and losing 85% of the business to getting it back, you know, all types of ups and downs. But again, part of that building, scaling, financing that we like to hear. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Luke Sanders. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me today.
So originally from New Jersey, one of seven siblings, my God, a household full of action. How was life growing up? Give us a walk through memory lane.
It was great. I actually, I can't really fall asleep unless there's like lots of things happening around me. So I love that chaos. And I think it's a big part of being an entrepreneur and sort of embracing ambiguity and all the adventures. And so some days you were hanging out with the older siblings and they were taking you places and doing crazy stuff. And other times you were the older sibling. And I was just, it was a really special experience. And we had a pretty entrepreneurial family. So we were always doing stuff like lemonade stands or trying to start businesses on the side.
So I guess in your case, you ended up going to San Luis out of all places, you know, for university. But it was like, it took a little bit of time there, you know, because you ended up kind of like getting a gap year, then getting back. I mean, then getting into the whole thing of entrepreneurship with a bike rental. I mean, quite the ups and downs there in university too.
Yeah, I mean, university was great. I wanted to get out of the Northeast and St. Louis seemed like a good place to be. The university is right in the city. So that's really what I wanted. I was interested in studying Chinese and international studies. And I thought I'm going to move to China. And I did end up living there for about 6 to 9 months during college, but ultimately had a bike rental company on the side. And that was really where I was spending most of my time and was my passion. So I decided to skip the job market after school and go to work with my dad in a small grease lubricant manufacturing business.
So then let's talk about, you know, that real quick, because when you joined, you know, it was kind of like, you know, a different type of operation. I mean, there was like no real monitoring on the numbers, and you found quite the scary, you know, part, you know, with only a couple of months of runway when, you know, the truth came to tell. So how was that for you?
It was an interesting experience on a lot of levels. So it was a company that my dad had been running for about 30 years. It was small, like, you know, $500,000 in revenue. You know, maybe two people, like one and two part-time people working there. And really ended up in a difficult situation because of the financial crisis at the time, and some of their cost structure had gotten out of hand. But it was a classic example where you're running the business based on how much cash is in the bank at the end of the month and not based on a detailed P&L. So when I got there, the cash was going out of the bank pretty quickly and getting pretty low, and I didn't really understand where it was all going. But I had been under the impression that the business was profitable, and I had them redo the books and take the chart of accounts, and we rebuilt the whole P&L. And what did we learn? We learned we were losing about 30%. So, and we had about 2 months of runway. So it was, I mean, we were doing everything we could to cut costs. We changed the phones from, you know, this really expensive AT&T thing to a voice over IP system. We got rid of the fax machine. Like, we were down into the pennies. We had like a postage mailer that somebody had signed up for that was like $1,000 a month. And I just sent it back to the company and said, you know, send it to collections. I can't afford this. And I was literally mixing the grease and answering the phone and putting the orders through. So it was a great experience after getting through that period. But it was really challenging, and it was surprisingly like a startup, considering that it was like a 30-year-old business with pretty long-term customers.
So what was that conversation like, where all of a sudden, you know, you realize that there's just a couple of months of runway, and kind of like people have been under a different impression? You know, what was that conversation like?
Well, I was having it with my dad, which was a kind of an awkward experience because, you know, you're like, hey, Dad, I think this is going to be out of business in like 2 or 3 months. And he's like, what do you mean? That's not even possible, because he's been sort of operating it for 30 years without any issues. And what had happened is a lot of their costs had gone up and then the revenue went down. And so he hadn't been in the same position before. But it was tough. I mean, it was really tough, because I said, we have to make some really big changes. We basically have, we only have two employees. We can't afford either of them. We need to move our manufacturing operations from New York to New Jersey and save a ton of money through that. And then we have to like hold our breath and hope that our working capital doesn't get so low that we can't buy new inventory. And like, let's see how it goes. So, but I think, you know, I remember him saying, you know, are you sure? And, you know, what happens if you're wrong and all that stuff? I said, well, the only thing I know for sure is this is not going to go in the right direction. So we got to try something.
That's amazing. So obviously, you know, working on a turnaround like that, you know, gave you, you know, some really nice jobs on really understanding, you know, how to make a business profitable. And in your case, your wife ended up pursuing law school, went to Michigan, you went with her. And that was a really nice, you know, switch, you know, of gears for you, because then you went into sales, but obviously not the best, you know, type of, you know, job that you had hoped for, but it gave you some really nice time to listen to Stanford classes. So how was that for you?
So, I mean, I think sales, it's probably the best experience I got to be prepared to be an entrepreneur. If you can't articulate the value proposition that your business has, and you don't get comfortable getting lots of no's and, you know, having to do cold outreach and try to make relationships and solve problems with people you don't know, I just learned so much through that job. And that's why I took it. I mean, ultimately I was like, okay, I can help out at the business on the side for the grease lubricant manufacturing, but I'm going to get somebody else to invest in me and learning this really valuable skill. And then, you know, I got to, it, but the downside was, yeah, I was driving 1,000 miles a week. So I had a lot of time to listen to podcasts, take courses online. I listen to, you know, all the Game of Thrones books and things like that that I would never have time to do in my life today. So it was really a silver lining was I got to learn that skill. I got to learn a lot of other things along the way. And ultimately, while I was doing it, I came up with the idea for Farmer's Fridge.
So then tell us about this. You know, how did the idea of Farmer's Fridge come knocking? What was that incubation process like? And at what point you're like, okay, let's go?
Yeah. So the first part of it is if you've ever driven 1,000 miles a week across the country, so I covered Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, and Kentucky, what you find is a lot of places that you're visiting, the only options for lunch are a fast food restaurant. And sometimes it's like one fast food restaurant and a gas station. And there's a lot of conversation about, you know, do people want to eat healthy food? Maybe they don't even like it. Why are we talking so much about this? And my reality was, I like eating healthy food when it tastes good. I don't know where I can get it right now. It's not even an option. So there's got to be a better way to do this. And a lot of my clients were actually big CPG manufacturing companies making granola bars and cereal and cookies. So I was seeing inside these factories and how they do that. And it was so interesting to see, you know, you'd actually see like the whole grains or the whole chocolate chips coming in one end and leaving the other end in a box. But, you know, employees were walking out the front with the box of granola bars under their arm. But the ones that were going on the truck weren't going to get to the gas station down the street for like 2 months because it goes through this really long supply chain that's optimized around products that are shelf stable. So, and then on the other end, you have restaurants, and it's really like there were restaurant models, one of the only oldest businesses in the world. There's examples of restaurants from 2000 plus years ago. It's the same idea. You walk in, you talk to the sales team in the front. Then the manufacturing team makes it to order in the back. Accounting shows up and takes your check. And it's just, it's like everything a business does under one roof at every location. It's very inefficient. And so the idea was like, if you could make restaurant quality food in a CPG manufacturing setting, it would be much cheaper and more consistent. The issue is just getting it to people quickly. So how do you do that? And it kind of backed into the idea for the vending machine because the vending machine can go places restaurants can't go. It's actually the number one form of food service. So 100 million people today are going to go to a vending machine to buy something. And it would help us control inventory and understand customer relationships. So it was sort of all those insights converging. And me genuinely not knowing any better about how hard it would be to actually scale this up to where we are today.
So what was that moment where you were like, wow, I got to do this?
I kind of came home one weekend. I was talking to my wife about it, and I'd always had these ideas, wanted to be an entrepreneur. So she'd always say, okay, you know, that one, sometimes she'd be like, that sucks. Don't work on that. That's a waste of your time. And okay. And maybe I'd rethink it, come back. But the next step was always to throw it into a financial model. Like just think through what would the economics look like? How would the scale? I did that and I showed it to her. She's like, this is not the worst idea I've ever seen you come up with. And so then I wrote a business plan. It's probably only 7 or 8 pages, but it was like, this is why this should exist and how I'm going to execute. And, you know, she was like, oh, that's it. You know, I started sharing with people. They're like, you're going to never sleep. You're going to work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, because we're going to make food overnight and drop it off in the morning. It was crazy town. But I had enough traction with people to take the jump. And what I started doing is like working it. I actually went to a local cafe and I offered the woman, because I liked their food a lot. They had some good grab and go options. I offered her $15 an hour to let me work there and ask a lot of questions. I was like, I'll work, but I want to be asking you a ton of questions. So for the inconvenience, I'll actually pay you. And I'm going to come when I feel like it because I have another job. So it was a pretty interesting experience, and I'll never forget her and her husband worked there, and she was like, I think this will work. And he's like, I think it's a terrible idea. And, you know, here we are 10 years later. So
then what happened next? You know, after you're like going through these same initial stages, your wife, you know, gives you the okay, you know, you're like taking some insights, you know, from other folks, you know, like what happened next?
So the biggest challenge we had was what does the vending machine look like? Like, how does it actually work? And because I knew at the early stages, it couldn't just be like throw food in a vending machine. For starters, like most refrigerated vending machines are for, you know, Coke and Pepsi products and don't work well for what we do. But it didn't, it just didn't seem like it would create the right impression with a consumer to spend, because the premise is you're going to spend $8 or $9 or $10. So it'll be, you know, cheaper than going to a fast casual restaurant where a salad might cost $15 or $20, but it's going to be a lot more expensive than a dollar candy bar. So the machine has to feel different. It has to feel more like a restaurant than like a vending machine. So I looked into building a machine. I got a quote from an industrial designer for $500,000 to do prototype development. It wasn't even a finished product. And I was like, I don't have that kind of money. I think I had $25,000 or $50,000 in savings and credit card. So I went to the vending show in Las Vegas. I found a machine, kind of retrofitted it in our garage and got that up and running. And then we found one location. I thought everyone would be lining up to get, you know, fresh meals right in their lobby. Well, it turns out most places wanted nothing to do with us. Like, this is not, I don't know what this is. I don't need it. So we were in the crappiest food court in Chicago, but we got a location, and it was really everything for those next 6 months. It was like getting that machine ready, getting the menu ready, getting it. I rented a shared kitchen. So I could only afford to rent like one table for an hour kind of thing. And that was it. We got the first fridge open in October of 2013. And everything changed from that moment forward, because we actually had customers who were coming. And
have a question or need how-to advice? Just ask Meta AI. Whether you need to summarize your class notes or want to create a recipe with the ingredients you already have in your fridge, Meta AI has the answers. You can also research topics, explore interests, and so much more. It's the most advanced AI at your fingertips. Expand your world with Meta AI. Now on Instagram, WhatsApp, Facebook, and Messenger.
Imagine earning a degree that prepares you with real skills for the real world. Capella University's programs teach skills relevant to your career, so you can apply what you learn right away. Learn how Capella can make a difference in your life at capella.edu.
At Ashley, you'll find colorful furniture that brings your home to life. Ashley makes it easier than ever to express your personal style with an array of looks in fun trending hues to choose from earth tones to vibrant colors to calming blues and greens. Ashley has pieces for every room in the house in the season's most sought-after shades. A more colorful life starts at Ashley. Shop in-store, online today. Ashley, for the love of home.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.
Taking our product and all that.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So Again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So then for the people that are listening, you know, to really get it, what ended up being the business model of Farmer's Fridge? How do you guys make money?
We make money by selling you lunch or breakfast or, you know, a salad for dinner. Basically, we put the fridge in and then the food that we sell from that fridge is our revenue. So everything before that, we make the food in a centralized kitchen in Chicago. Then we do the last mile delivery to the individual locations and you show up and buy stuff. But the core model is like we're an integrated manufacturing, distribution, and retail. So it's very expensive up front. You're basically three businesses in one with a high fixed cost. But the variable cost on a salad is very low. So like if you go to the grocery store and you look at the price of lettuce per pound, it's not high. This is one of the things that didn't make any sense to me when I was looking at why there's no healthy food. Fruits and vegetables are the cheapest things in the grocery store, you know, and so but you have to centralize the production to keep it safe, to make it consistent, to do all that. But that's really the key to making money in our business is scale. So like at one fridge, we had a good unit economic model at the fridge level, and we had really good traction with customers. But you need like 2,000 locations to actually make money. And so it's everything between location number one, and now we're in around 2,000, just over 2,000 between fridges and the retail business that we do, was a slog because you have to essentially add overhead and infrastructure to be able to support the future growth. And you don't have enough vending machines online. So one of our board members, I'll never forget, he said, you know, you have a blessing and a curse. The blessing is the unit economics of a vending machine are great. The curse is you're going to need like 1,000 of them to make this work. So
as you're supporting the growth and, you know, talking about being capital intensive, how did you guys go about the capital raise and making sure that you were able to capitalize every life cycle of the business? Because I know that you guys have raised, you know, about $121 million to date. So what were those cycles, you know, that you guys went through and how were those expectations too that you were encountering from investors?
Yeah, I would say this is one of the biggest learning curves for me as an entrepreneur over the last 10 years. Every time I meet someone who's just getting started, I say to them, listen, you got to sit down and think through like, what are those key milestones? What's the exit look like? Kind of work backwards and plan your capital needs and what that means for you in terms of dilution and returns and just really make sure you understand that. Because that's ultimately in a startup, it's going to be a huge component of your success and how much money you make. So, but I say that because I didn't have that experience going in. I was a small business entrepreneur is how I describe it. So, you know, you had money in your bank account, you were profitable or you didn't. If you went negative, you had a runway. And if you didn't get positive again, by the end of that runway, you were dead. Like nobody would have invested venture capital into my grease business. So when I got started, I thought this would be a great small business where I would kind of have the first location and use the money from the first location to buy the second location. And the vending machine is kind of bite-sized, right? You could, for 10 grand, you could do the next one and the next one and the next one. The issue is that the infrastructure you need to support that is actually more than a restaurant up front. So like our commissary kitchen is something that you have to cover. So once I realized that, I was like, oh shoot, I'm gonna have to raise money. And I read the Venture Deals book and the, you know, number one best-selling book on Amazon for how to raise money. And somebody actually recommended it to me because they came and said, I want to invest in your company, but you have no idea what you're doing about raising money. So read this book and then come back to me when you're ready. And I did, and they actually gave me my first term sheet. And then from there, kind of moving forward, it was very much, you know, each stage, how much capital do we need to get to the next big milestone? And then we would go out and find partners to do that. And the mix changed. It went from venture to strategic over time, just because, you know, the bigger we got, the more important it was to have people helping us.
That's amazing. So obviously for investors too, I mean, when they give you the money, they're expecting, you know, and they're betting on a vision, right? Just like, you know, your employees would do, no? Now, I guess when it comes to the vision, if you were to go to sleep tonight, look, and you wake up in a world where the vision for Farmers Fridge is fully realized, what does that world look like?
I think, so we, you know, we say it as we make fresh, healthy food as accessible as a candy bar. So that means you're operating at a scale equivalent to the biggest CPG products or QSR restaurants. So something like 40 or 50 million people today in the US are going to go to a McDonald's restaurant and buy something. And I would say if we can get to that kind of scale, it might take us another 80 years, but that would, to me, would be success. I mean, it's having something that is fresh and healthy and at the same scale as the biggest food products, you know, I think that's what should happen. I think that's what will happen. The question is just how long is it going to take?
Now, for you also, you know, you guys have been scaling as well the employees. I mean, right now between contractors and full-timers, you have about 500. How has it been to scaling that and then also making sure that culture doesn't break?
Yeah. So first of all, when I started, one of the premises of the business was actually I'm going to have way less people, because restaurants, they need all these people, but a vending machine, it just spits out food, right? So you don't need a lot of people. It's going to be like all robots. And very quickly you realize people are still really good at making food. I think there'll be robotics, and we do a lot of automation now at scale. But things like, you know, cutting certain vegetables and assembling certain, you know, you're not going to see a Michelin star restaurant go to a robot anytime soon. So we ended up in a position where that was very clear after the first couple weeks, because I legitimately tried to do every job myself and I got talked out of it. So we hired a couple people. Now, as far as the culture, you know, so once we knew we had to scale up with people, we started doing that. It's mostly hourly. So the culture of Farmers Fridge is very unique in that sense. We're not a software company where it's all engineers. We have a company where we have salespeople and engineering people and hourly employees and people that were hourly employees that are now salaried supervisors making over $100,000 a year. So the two things I've tried to do, one is we wrote down all the values at one point and what we thought the culture should be. And after about 6 months, everybody was pointing to that stuff and talking about it, but not actually behaving in the ways that we wanted. So I ripped it up and threw it in the trash and said, look, culture is going to be how we behave. We're going to behave in a way that signals the right culture. And that's what we do. We just kind of like, from me and my team, like, do you, the behavior that you accept and that you encourage is going to be the culture that you have. And it doesn't matter what you write down or, you know, what you put on the wall, that's what's going to happen. So that's what we try really hard to do. And we go out of our way to blend the culture by making people do things like go on ride-alongs, work in the kitchen. You know, if something's running short at the facility, we take volunteers from corporate to go down there and pack jars. But trying to make sure people don't lose sight of the fact that this is a business that, despite my best efforts, is very dependent on people and really high quality, committed people that come in every day and make the food and deliver the food. And so that's what makes our business work.
So obviously, you know, the way that you guys have been able to go through the ups and downs, you know, is really remarkable. I mean, in COVID, you guys literally lost 85%, you know, of the revenue. I mean, that's pretty amazing. And the fact that you guys were able to push through that and keep fighting and get back on top. So how was that, you know, for you all? And I guess, who do you think you needed to be as the leader of the company?
Yeah. It's interesting. The leadership changes and evolves quite a bit depending on what kind of situation you're in at a company at a given time. So sometimes you're trying to be hands off to give the team some room to grow and learn and make mistakes. And other times you're micromanaging, because if you don't, you make one mistake, you're dead. So I think trying to find that balance over the years is one of the biggest challenges of this job or any entrepreneur's journey. But it does change. And I think that that's really important to keep in mind. As far as what changed in COVID, that was one of those times where it's sort of like all hands on deck. Like we were doing daily stand-ups and doing all kinds of crazy things that normally we'd spend a lot of time doing analysis or asking questions. And it's actually one of the things I love about being a startup is you kind of live every day like it's your last day. When you're a big mature company and you have a lot of money, you get really comfortable. In a startup, you have to change your behavior. You have to question every assumption. So we almost just went into super startup mode. Everything was like, look, we're dead tomorrow if we don't figure this out. So we're going to launch a home delivery program and I want it up and running by Monday. And people were like, what? Like, how do you do that? And I said, well, have you ever heard of Shopify? Because like you can set up a website like this afternoon and start selling stuff. And you know, the team was kind of skeptical at first and they got on there and they did it. And by Monday we were in the delivery business. And then the other thing, you want to take a step back and look at like, what are your actual assets? Like, so in our case, we were really good at making food. We're really good at distributing food. The vending machine is cool, but it's not actually like the thing that is, you're buying a salad, right? So we're the logistics company. So I said to the sales team, like, hey, why don't you guys call up the hospitals? Don't try to sell them anything. Just ask them if they need help. Like, is there anything we can help you guys with? And they did. They called them and they were like, we need grab and go. We need fresh food. But we also don't want it. We don't want it all in the cafeteria because we don't want people to get sick. So if you can figure out a way to set us up with food going into all, you know, 35 locations at some of these hospitals, we'll start buying it tomorrow. So our sales team called me. They're like, we need to go buy 100 mini fridges. And we think we can get, you know, X millions of dollars in revenue if we do this, and it'll be guaranteed. And it's kind of stuff for like, you know, maybe you'd sit around and think about it for a little while. You're like, okay, tell them yes and get those fridges on a truck to New York like yesterday. And that's what got us through it, is that kind of decisiveness and creativity that's really, it's in a startup's DNA.
That's amazing. Now, you've been at it for quite a while with Farmers Fridge, you know, about a decade. You know, that like in corporate world is like 100 years. Eh? It's amazing. Now, let's say I was to put you into a time machine. And I bring you back, you know, perhaps to 2013 when you are, you know, still doing sales, you know, at the grease company. And you're able to have a sit down with that younger self, that maybe just got the approval from your wife, you know, to look farther into this. And you're able to have a sit down with that younger look and give that younger look one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
Ooh, I think it would be the advice I give now. Like, hey, think through the capital structure and the key milestones and how are you really going to fund this capital intensive business? Because that was the one piece I didn't really understand on first day. And to be clear, as soon as I started, it was clear. But it was something that, you know, was very dependent on, well, how much salad are you really going to sell and how much space do you need? There's a lot of unknowns in that equation. But I think it would have been, I would be able to give them all that information. I would say, hey, like, because I'm assuming it's me, I'd be able to say, you know, here's what the revenue is going to be per location. Here's how much the box is going to cost. Here's how much the routes are going to need to do to hit this cost target. So I'd be more helpful. But that's the thing. I would like try to lay this out as a 10-year plan. And it would have saved me a lot of time and energy. And I think the company ultimately got there and it's been a lot of fun. But that would accelerate the most.
So for the people that are listening, look, I would love to reach out and say hi. What is the best way for them to do so?
I'm very easy to find. You can just email me. It's my name at farmersfridge.com. It's pretty easy. And LinkedIn, I probably won't see it. So don't try to get in touch with me that way. And please, if you're trying to sell something, don't be offended if I don't get back to you. I might just forward it to someone on my team who is more relevant. But happy to reply or give advice and pay it forward. Because yeah, I can't help my past self. Unfortunately, I don't have a time machine, but I do consider it part of my job to sort of pay it forward and help other people think through their future.
Amazing. Well, hey, look, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.
Have a question or need how-to advice? Just ask Meta AI. Whether you want to design a marathon training program or you're curious what planets are visible in tonight's sky, Meta AI has the answers. It can also summarize your class notes, visualize your ideas, and so much more. It's the most advanced AI at your fingertips. Expand your world with Meta AI. Now on Instagram, WhatsApp, Facebook, and Messenger.
Earning your degree online doesn't mean you have to go about it alone. At Capella University, we're here to support you when you're ready. From enrollment counselors who get to know you and your goals, to academic coaches who can help you form a plan to stay on track, we care about your success and are dedicated to helping you pursue your goals. Going back to school is a big step, but having support at every step of your academic journey can make a big difference. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
At Ashley, you'll find colorful furniture that brings your home to life. Ashley makes it easier than ever to express your personal style with an array of looks in fun trending hues to choose from earth tones to vibrant colors to calming blues and greens. Ashley has pieces for every room in the house in the season's most sought-after shades. A more colorful life starts at Ashley. Shop in-store, online today. Ashley, for the love of home.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall Credit Card Bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.